This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, They shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello. Regardless of a possible ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel, today's world confronts a critical and urgent issue. How to hold Israel accountable for its inhumane aggression on Gaza? This is not just about politics or international relations. It is a matter of human lives, dignity and justice. The world has witnessed the devastating impact of the conflict on the people of Gaza, and it is a moral duty to explore ways to ensure accountability for the crimes being committed. Through the lenses of international law, human rights and ethics, we should examine the mechanisms and strategies that can lead to meaningful accountability and pave the way for just and lasting peace. Welcome to Spotlight.
As the call for justice in Gaza resonates across the world, more countries are stepping forward to join South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice. In December 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice stating that Israel is engaging in genocidal acts in Gaza.
This institutionalized impunity has led Israel to engage in this genocide, which has shocked the conscience of humanity. South Africa is mindful that the present genocide operates in denial of the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and collective right to return to their homes in Palestine.
Also, last January, the ICJ ruled that Israel must take all measures within its power to prevent genocide in Gaza.
Israel must also take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Genocide Convention.
The interim ruling has set a precedent for international legal action against human rights violations. Meanwhile, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has called for arrest warrants for Israeli leaders implicated in crimes committed against Palestinians, including those in the Gaza Strip.
Today, I'm filing applications for warrants of arrest before Pretrial Chamber 1 of the International Criminal Court in the situation in the state of Palestine.
As the Israeli regime's crimes continue to draw condemnation around the globe, 14 countries, including Ireland and Cuba, have expressed their intention to join South Africa's case against Israel at the ICJ. This while truce talks between Hamas and Israel are expected to end up in a deal soon. Now, these questions remain to be answered. How can justice be served given Israeli officials' defiance of court rulings? And in case a truce is reached in Gaza, will efforts continue to hold the Israeli criminals accountable?
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guest in this episode of Spotlight. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol, UK. And Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Glasgow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, very good to have you on the program. Tony, I'm going to start with you. We know that Cuba has officially declared its intention to join South Africa's case against Israel. That makes the tally up to like 14 countries now. Do you think this is going to gain momentum now? How is it going to change the game?
Well, let me try and put this in context, because the last real mass slaughter based around religion that we saw was during the Second World War. People have been comparing the treatment of the Palestinian, mostly Muslims, many Christians and others, though, to the Nazi treatment of the Jews. This idea that really encompasses is the separation of people. So we are the Übermensch and they are the Untermensch, the under people, the animals. This is exactly the sort of language that the Nazis were using back in the 1930s and 1940s against Jews, Slavs, and other minority groups such as Gypsies. So we have to understand where this concept comes from. Obviously, it goes back a long, long way. But in Germany, particularly, it was the philosopher Nietzsche in the end of the 19th century that wrote a book called Also Spake Zarathustra. And this idea of the Übermensch and the Untermensch is key to understanding how a society can deliberately, and a state can deliberately condition its people to think of human beings as animals and treat them so terribly. So that's the context. But back in, and I'm quite positive about the International Criminal Court and the International Justice and what they're doing, even though, of course, the wheels of justice turn painfully slowly. It took, back in the Second World War, it took 10 years, even a bit more than 10 years, to actually finally bring the war criminals of Nazi Germany, the SS, etc., to justice. One or two of them did escape, that's true, but the Nuremberg tribunals in 1946 did. Now, what we're seeing now is the wheels of justice, even just after a year, less than a year, in fact, the processes. And let me just take my hat off to the Hind Rajab Foundation and their ability to get together the evidence, much of which has been shared through really disgusting videos posted by Israeli Defense Force soldiers online, really mocking the people that they're killing in an absolutely disgusting fashion. But they've taken on many of those videos and footage at the Hind Rajab Foundation and presented them to the International Court of Justice as evidence. And we're now looking at 50 specific soldiers with specific evidence of war crimes that they've committed, not just those in charge in Tel Aviv.
Right, Tony. Mick, Tony just mentioned the Hind Rajab Foundation. That was part of the question that I wanted to pose for you. Can you tell me what's the significance of the acts of the Hind Rajab Foundation? We know that they successfully managed to get an Israeli soldier imprisoned in jail, at least for now in Brazil, arrested for now. And they are now campaigning for another arrest of a major general in Italy. How do you think is the significance of this? And is this going to continue while now that there's the talk of a ceasefire deal?
I mean, it's tremendously significant. In the past, we have seen, I think it was 2008, an Israeli war criminal, Doron Almog, landed at Heathrow Airport in London. And the police were waiting for him with handcuffs, because a magistrate had issued an arrest warrant for his war crimes in Gaza. Now, he was tipped off and the plane took off and he didn't end up behind bars. But there have been many examples of this, where magistrates responding to pressure, responding to over a compelling case that an individual has committed war crimes, have issued arrest warrants. And the Israelis, for a while, warned their citizens against travelling to Spain. They warned many of them about the risks of travelling to Britain. Tzipi Livni, an ex-diplomat, had to hide. She came over to speak to a Zionist meeting, the Jewish National Fund in London, and she had to skip it because she was afraid of arrests. So the threat of arrests has been there for a while, and it was good to see the warrant issued in Brazil for the Israeli soldier. The information I have, perhaps you've got more up-to-date information, is that he was allowed to escape by sections of the Brazilian military and is now in Argentina. But the fact is, the issuing of that arrest warrant, that civil society groups like the Hind Rajab Foundation show us what is possible. Over the last 20 years, we've seen the growth of the BDS movement. That is self-organized groups in civil society taking it upon themselves to take action to boycott and isolate the state of Israel. A comparable movement dedicated to gathering intelligence on Israeli citizens, because as your other guest says, they make videos of their war crimes, of their atrocities, of their degenerate behavior. So there's a mountain of information out there on social media. If we can find the organizations, 1,000 examples of the Hind Rajab Foundation, people who follow that inspiration to get arrest warrants issued for Israelis wherever they travel, it could make a huge difference, because they have enjoyed impunity. They have faced arrest. When Doron Almog faced arrest in Britain, Jack Straw, the Home Secretary, apologised to Israel for the inconvenience he had suffered and guaranteed it wouldn't happen again. But it still can happen. There are technical reasons why it can. So very inspiring from Hind Rajab, very inspiring in Brazil. And I think it's if it can be copied, it can make a substantial difference, because we cannot rely on the heads of governments to pursue Israel, apart from the 14 who've already taken this stand.
Right. Now, Tony, we know that during the genocide in the past 15 months, the international community has failed enormously in containing the genocide, containing the Israeli atrocities in Gaza. Now, with all the talk and the hype about the possible truce that is going to happen in the next hours or so, what do you think? Of course, the Israelis want everything to die down, everything to be swept under the carpet. But do you think this will be the case, or there will be justice now?
Well, look, let's take the previous so-called ceasefire agreements as examples. They were jumped on by the far-right bloc now controlling Israel, which I must say does not represent Israeli people as a whole. There is a lot of support for them, obviously, in Israel, but there are many, many people in civil society that don't support this. And what they're doing, really, is trying very hard to get their way with these specific individuals. But, I mean, if you look at the wider... Sorry, I'm going back again to look at the bigger picture. I think it's important to understand what's going on. You've got Josh Paul today, a former senior official at the US State Department, actually quoting him, saying that the war, Israel's war in Gaza, is made in America. So this is what I'm saying about the ceasefire, is that this is crucial. Trump coming in now with a new administration, with a whole bunch of new officials, they will be absolutely key, but there's no guarantees that they are going to want what the rest of the world wants, which is to see this slaughter finish. So that's the picture. There's many people, including, for example, Jeffrey Sachs, very well-respected Jewish economist, and he's become a political advisor in the United States, also calling out the Middle East situation as really made in America. And I would remind you, it's interesting to hear, I didn't know that this Israeli soldier in Brazil had found some sort of safe haven in Argentina, because we know, anybody that's looked into this, the British that looked into it, even the World in Action documentary program back in the 1970s found many ex-SS, ex-Nazis hiding in Argentina, because Argentina was a perfect place, Patagonia being very German, lots of Nazi sympathizers in Argentina. And now, of course, we've got a what you would call anarcho-capitalist government in Argentina. This is the sort of place which will help to hide somebody like that. So the links to the Nazis, I think, are really important to understand. If you go back all that way, you'll find many of the Nazis fled to the United States. So it shouldn't come as a great surprise that we're seeing the United States backing this. The only big question over this ceasefire is, are they going to do the same as they did in the previous ceasefires and use them as just an excuse, a cynical excuse, to using electronic means, tracing phones and things like this, to kill, destroy, maim the people that they're supposed to be negotiating with, as we saw with Nasrallah in Beirut, that absolutely disgusting. The UN, they had announced that there was about to be a peace deal. And then what did we see? The Israelis and the United States coordinating their satellite intelligence to assassinate Nasrallah. And that's happened many times in these negotiations. So all I say is, don't hold your breath.
Right, Tony, you mentioned we should look at the other examples, other possible scenarios, ceasefire scenarios that you've had, which reminds me of what happened between Israel and Lebanon. At least in Lebanon, there is the Lebanese army to oversee the enforcement of the ceasefire. And despite that, we are seeing daily violations by the Israeli forces in Lebanon, killing people, still killing people there, and staying there, and just ignoring the ceasefire practically. Who is going to be the body who's going to oversee the enforcement of a possible ceasefire in Gaza? And if there will be any violations, who is going to hold them accountable for them? For Mick. I'm asking Mick, yeah.
Okay. The agreement is to be overseen by the governments of Egypt, Qatar, and the USA. So one has to be extremely cautious, because the Egyptian government they've held their noses for the last few years, but they have also worked with Israel to enforce the siege of Gaza. So the question of agency that you raise is absolutely central. There is no agency that one could have confidence in. And Israel and America work as virtually inseparable partners. And sometimes they disagree about minor details, but they're virtually inseparable partners. So how this is going to go forward, Israel will remain the local most technologically advanced military superpower. But, and it's a huge but, they have failed to defeat the Palestinian resistance. And this is absolutely crucial. The fact that even though they hold many of the cards going forward, the absolute determination, the courage, the heroism of the Palestinian resistance has denied them their main war aim, which was to obliterate that resistance. And it's worth saying many, many times over, in unconventional war such as this, for the dominant colonial or colonizing power to win, they need to obliterate resistance. They've failed. For the for the opposition, for the resistance to win. They don't have to conquer territory. They merely have to survive. They have to hang on. They have to deny victory to the opposition. And by any conventional military yardstick, Israel has not secured its goals. It has caused tremendous suffering across Gaza. I think they've obliterated 85 or 87% of buildings. They've caused huge suffering until now and going forward, but they have not won. And that's what is very important for Israel. So I think that there is no reliable agency to enforce this. The only thing which will keep the Israelis from violating it at will is the knowledge that they cannot win and that there will be a cost to pay. And I have to say this as well. For many, many years, well before October 2023, up until the present day, the Palestinians have won one of the most important battles, which is the battle for worldwide public opinion. Even before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israel was a polecat state, was very, very unpopular, even among the populations of their main allies, Britain, America, Germany, and so on. But since Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, over the last 16 months, Israel has reached what they understand to be a crisis, that the intensity of the hostility towards Israel has reached such a pitch that they're quite worried about it. And Trump will not be prepared to pay a heavy political price to protect Israel. His pro-Israel policy has been bought by Sheldon Adelson's widow for $250 million to his campaign fund. So he's totally in the Zionist camp. But I don't think he's a reliable ally, because he's quite capricious and quite willing to play to his base, which is not by any means very sympathetic to Israel.
Tony, Israel is claiming that the ICC has no jurisdiction over it. Is such a claim enough to get rid of any legal pursuit?
Well, it's the sort of claim that the Nazi Germany would have made in the Second World War against international justice. I mean, basically, that's what they're saying is the law does not apply to us. They are the men of lawlessness. That's who they are running Israel right now. They're not interested in the rule of law. They're interested in the power coming from the barrel of a gun or possibly a nuclear weapon, which they try to deny that they still have. And I think it's quite crucial to understand that the way that the Israelis have managed over the years to infiltrate and to influence the mass media. I mean, I myself used to work for the BBC in London, and I've seen over the years a gradual change in their attitude over the years towards Israel. Very sceptical to begin with. During, for example, the first Gulf War back in 1990, quite good historical background coverage. Very little now, but the mainstream media, mainly led by the Murdoch Empire, who have big financial interests, have been extremely powerful in trying to. And I think this has been betrayed in a way over the Christmas holiday by Rafi Berg, who's at the BBC as a former worker with the CIA front organization, now as their online Middle East editor. We're starting to see people within the mass media, even in the Western world, start to call out those Zionist agents who are working within the media. And if you remember the pager explosions back in October 2024, the agents came out on CBS News and they said, all the world is our stage. That's what they said. And that's because what they're betraying there is their massive influence over the Western press. They've got their people in who are basically controlling the narrative as it comes out day after day. For example, a former Labour MP has been arrested in Britain here for trying to procure in a sexual manner schoolboys in Brighton over the last few days. Virtually no coverage on the television or the radio, a little bit in the newspaper. And that's the sort of influence that they have, because they know that this is the way that you control the population, simply by trying to squash any story which is negative about the Zionists. And that's another thing is this. I think this is really, really important, is you've got a home front as well. So over the Christmas break, We had a massive campaign all over the BBC about the 2005-7/7 London bombings, trying to blame the whole thing. So all these Muslims, they're terrible, they're blowing up London. Well, I can tell you, the actual blame seems to be on a Israeli company being run in London at the time who put bombs underneath the trains, not inside the trains. So
right.
They trying to push this whole agenda. We've got a massive home front, is what I'm saying here, in the UK. And slowly but surely, people are realising, hey, we're being had here. And this is all very bad, I think, ultimately, for the Israeli state. We're pushing them against the wall now.
Right, Tony. Now, Mick, as we discussed, you know, the arrest warrants is one thing, and a real trial and conviction is a totally different matter. How do you think is that going to happen? What steps should be taken to actually bring the people in charge of the genocide, people who are running the genocide, to justice?
I think it depends entirely upon the kind of effective pressure that can be built up from below in our societies against the likes of the UK government and Starmer. Because we have seen Ireland, we have seen Belgium, we have seen Spain join South Africa with 10 other countries in their case at the European at the International Court. Having said that, there is tremendous resistance to this going to the court and being successful. We know that our governments work very, very closely with the Israelis. They know exactly what Israel has been doing. They have in the past actually almost endorsed, not quite, but when British or American citizens have been killed by the Israeli military, shot dead when they're protecting Palestinian school children, the governments have been on the side of Israel against their own citizens. So that determined support for Israel is still there, but it comes up against increasingly determined support among the population. And if I can sound one note of optimism, the reason why people in Britain are now being sent to prison, are being jailed and fired from their jobs for supporting Palestine is because our elites know that they have lost the debate. If they had won the debate, if our opinions were marginal, they would ignore us. But the jailings, the legislation going through Congress for a £1 million fine for a 10-year sentence for campaigning for BDS against Israel.
Thank you, Mick.
Several signs that they've lost the debate.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. It was a pleasure to have you in the programme. We are pressed for time. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Once again, Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol, UK, and also Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Glasgow. This was another Spotlight. Thank you.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. and may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet Muhammad and his household. Assalamu alaikum, my dear audience. Welcome to the series of talks for humanity. This is Hamza Azizi. In the latter episodes, we have been talking about the significance of spiritual support that every believer must take care of in accordance with other believers. We mentioned different types of spiritual support and different examples. Recently, we talked about the obligation of keeping the secrets of other believers, as well as the obligation of disregarding and ignoring the rumors and accusations about other believers. Again, a very connected issue to this topic is, in general, to keep the reputation of other believers. It's very important in Islamic culture. In Islamic teachings, it is very important to keep the reputation of other believers, to the extent that we have in our narrations that the reputation of a believer, even it is more important than Kaaba, the house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Mecca. The Kaaba that is so much significant in our culture, in our narration said that hurmatul mu'mini a'lam min al-Kaaba. The reputation of a believer is even more significant than Kaaba. We have many verses in the Holy Book showing this significance. First of all, practically, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his practical laws has done everything to keep the reputation of the believers as much as possible. Even the reputation of the believers who have hardly ever or occasionally have done some crimes, have committed some sins. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when it comes to adultery, he says that the accusation of such crime, such sin, is not accepted even in a court, except that four witnesses, they witness explicitly the crime. It is, and almost, you know that it is almost impossible. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put such boundaries, such limitation to this? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to keep the reputation of the believers. Why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is so much careful about the reputations of the believers? Because this is the identity of the ummah, identity of the Islamic society. If the members of the society get accustomed to spread the rumors today and tomorrow, yesterday, about everyone, everywhere, after a while, after 1, 2, 3 months or years, this society would be torn apart. And the whole identity of the Islamic Ummah would be violated. And this is the point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even in his practical laws, has done everything and has brought every limitation, every possible limitation to keep this identity. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that if anyone accuses the others, a lady or a man, of adultery, and he does not bring the evidence, he would be punished. Or the witnesses, if they are less than four ones, and they come to the court and they witness and they announce this, they will be punished. So this is in practical side. Let's go to the moral side. We will see those verses as well. After a short break, inshallah, I will be back with you. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad ya muslimi sallu alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad sallu alayhi ya mu'mini sallu alayhi. Thank you. Welcome back to the series of Talks for Humanity. This is Hamza Azizi from Iran Radio. We've been talking about the significance of reputation of mu'mineen and believers. And we said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even in practical side and practical field, within the practical laws, He has done everything and he has brought every limitation to keep the reputations of the believers. In chapter Nisa, verse 15, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that وَالَّتِي يَأْتِينَ الْفَاحِشَةَ وَالَّتِي يَأْتِينَ الْفَاحِشَةَ مِن نِسَائِكُمْ فَاسْتَشْهِدُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ أَرْبَعَ. The ones who have done adultery as a sin, if you want to prove that, you need four witnesses. And on the other side, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter Nisa, verse 112, مَنْ يَكْسِبْ خَطِيئَةً أَوْ إِثْمًا ثُمَّ يَرْمِ بِهِ بَرِيئًا. If someone accuses the others, the other who is innocent, if he accuses him of a crime that he hasn't done, فَقَدْ احْتَمَلَ بُهْتَانًا وَإِثْمًا مُبِينًا. It is very obvious and imminent sin and crime, and it's an accusation. In the other verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in chapter Nur, verse 4, وَالَّذِينَ يَرْمُونَ الْمُحْصَنَاتِ ثُمَّ لَمْ يَأْتُوا بِأَرْبَعَةِ شُهَدَاءِ. The ones who accuses the others of sexual sins, and they are not going to bring the adequate number of witnesses, لَمْ يَأْتُوا بِأَرْبَعَةِ شُهَدَاءِ فَاجْلِدُوهُمْ ثَمَانِينَ. They must be punished, even though they might be right. But they do not have this right to come to the court except they are confident that all limitations have been kept and all the conditions have been preserved. They are not allowed to come to the court. In another verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, again in chapter Nur, verse 11, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ جَاءُوا بِالْإِفْكِ عُصْبَةٌ مِّنْكُمْ لَا تَحْسَبُوهُ شَرًّا لَكُمْ بَلْ هُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ لِكُلِّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ مَكْتَسَبَ مِنَ الْإِثْمِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that this story of ifk, which took place among the society, although it had a bad image, but it's a good thing that took place. Why? Maybe because the Islamic society has learned how to communicate, how to deal with other believers, with their religious brothers and sisters. They have to take care of their reputations. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحِبُّونَ أَن تَشِيعَ الْفَاحِشَةِ فِي الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ. The ones who like to spread the rumors of crimes about the other believers in the society, they will be punished both in this universe and in the hereafter. And also Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in other verses, I have many verses here. I cannot read all of them because of the shortage of time. But it all shows the significance of reputation of believers. And inshallah, when it comes to the other types of examples, we will elaborate them as well. But this all shows Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants all members of the society stick to each other, not to be separated because of the rumors, accusations, and the information that have not been proved yet in any legitimate occasion, any legitimate court. Inshallah, in the next episode, we will elaborate again on other examples of this spiritual support a little bit more. Thank you. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. Oh God, please don't deprive me a blissful life. One day all my deeds will be shown in front of you. No one will be beside me. I'll be standing on my own. Blessing me with your mercy is all I'm hoping for. Oh Allah, make my wishes come true.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For Yemen, support of Palestinians has become a national rallying cry uniting the country against imperialist and Zionist oppression and its Western backers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Exactly a year ago, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, in a much-hyped move, announced a two-pronged military campaign to subdue Yemen into submission. A full year and numerous military adventures later, the dual military operations, Prosperity Guardian and Poseidon Archer, have proved to be catastrophic failures, or perhaps more aptly, counterproductive fiascos. The United States, true to its reputation, schemed to disrupt and dismantle Yemen's resistance efforts in solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza. Instead, they encountered a naval debacle unmatched since the Second World War. Yemen's resistance, led by the Arab countries' military forces, began in late 2023, with precision air raids and attacks on vessels in regional waters carrying material aid to the Zionist regime. Leveraging their prime geostrategic position along the Bab al-Mandab Strait, Yemen declared an unequivocal embargo on trade with the Zionist regime as a mark of solidarity with the Palestinians. All other vessels were granted safe passage, provided they abstained from commerce with the Zionist entity and its key Western backers. Imperialist corporate Western media predictably spun Yemen's action as a blatant blockade of the Red Sea. But this narrative is a calculated distortion. The blockade has been precise and targeted, aimed solely at ships trading with the Zionist regime. This distinction is vital as dozens of vessels continue to transit the important strait daily without incident. In retaliation, the United States launched what it called Operation Prosperity Guardian in December of 2023, cobbling together a coalition of navies from compliant allies like Greece, Bahrain, Finland, Norway, Singapore, and the Seychelles. The latter prompted the martyred Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah to quip, "I had to Google it to find out where it even is." But this coalition was doomed before it ever set sail. Major European powers like France, Spain and Italy outright refused to participate, aware of its repercussions, leaving the coalition's credibility in tatters. Estonia contributed a solitary soldier to the imperialist cause, a gesture that bordered on satire. Weeks later, in January of 2024, Operation Poseidon Archer was launched after Yemen dismissed the hollow threats from this ragtag Western military coalition. While Operation Prosperity Guardian sought to assemble global opposition against Yemen, it floundered as a disorganized farce. Operation Poseidon Archer, by contrast, was a direct and concentrated US-UK initiative. The initial United States-Britain airstrikes against Yemen commenced on 12th of January 2024, targeting both military installations and civilian infrastructure. Over the course of 2024, the United States and Britain together bombed Yemen on 70 separate days, with some days seeing dozens of airstrikes. Not included in this tally are Israeli airstrikes, which occurred independently of the US-led aggression. The aggressors did not confine their strikes to Yemeni military targets. Fuel depots and power stations became routine targets in a bid to cripple the poorest Arab country, a classic imperialist tactic. This strategy, previously employed by the United States in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere, proved utterly ineffective against Yemen. Since the Al-Aqsa Flood Operation began, millions of Yemenis have marched every Friday in solidarity with Palestinians. They marched again on Friday, 10th of January, in Sana'a and other Yemeni cities. For Yemen, support for Palestine has become a national rallying cry, uniting the country against imperialist and Zionist oppression and its Western backers. To understand Yemen's resistance and resilience, one must consider the Yemeni Ansar Allah movement's history. A revolutionary anti-imperialist force, the Ansar Allah movement has withstood over a decade of relentless Saudi-US bombardment. Its military capabilities are forged in battle and backed by widespread popular support. Consequently, the US-led bombings only bolstered the movement's standing, deepening national solidarity. Muhammad al-Bukhaiti, a spokesperson for the Ansar Allah movement, recently said, "We won't abandon Palestine. It would mean a loss of our values." This unyielding vow accompanies every Yemeni military statement following operations against hostile vessels or targets. The aggressors' actions have merely escalated Yemeni resistance. The Al Mayadeen television network has also covered this same story and tells us more. Unsurprisingly, after the launch of Prosperity Guardian and Poseidon Archer operations, Yemen extended its blockade from the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea to encompass the entire Indian Ocean. Yemeni military forces have directly targeted US naval vessels using drones, ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. The Ansar Allah movement has struck destroyers and aircraft carriers, including the USS Stockdale, USS Spruance, USS Kearney, and USS Eisenhower. They have also destroyed multiple MQ-9 Reaper drones and downed a US F-18 fighter jet. Several aircraft carriers and destroyers have sustained significant damage, forcing their withdrawal from the region. To date, Yemeni resistance blockade has disrupted 171 commercial vessels. Meanwhile, the third largest port in the occupied Palestinian territories, the port of Eilat, has ceased operations entirely due to the blockade. By July of 2024, the port declared bankruptcy, citing Yemeni resistance as the primary cause. Once a bustling hub for trade, Eilat saw only one ship docked during the months-long blockade. Even the Pentagon officials are astounded. In November of 2024, Bill LaPlante, the Pentagon's chief weapons buyer, admitted, "I'm an engineer and a physicist, and I've been around missiles my whole career. What I've seen from Ansar Allah in the last 6 months is shocking." The US campaign has been such an unmitigated disaster that Yemen has extended its operations beyond the blockade. A new reality now grips the Zionist regime, Yemeni hypersonic missile strikes. Named Palestine 2, Yemen's homegrown hypersonic missile has penetrated Zionist military systems including David Sling and the Iron Dome, striking strategic targets in Jaffa, Tel Aviv, and the Negev Desert. Though drone and rocket attacks began in October of 2023, Yemen's true prowess emerged at the end of 2024. In December alone, hypersonic missile strikes rained down on Tel Aviv multiple times per week, forcing settlers into shelters and sowing widespread panic. The strikes, launched under the cover of darkness, caused structural devastation and psychological turmoil. Despite their best efforts, U.S. aircraft carriers and destroyers have been unable to intercept Yemen's advanced missiles and drones. In defiance of the U.S.-Britain alliance, Zionist aggression, and the inept coalition partners of Prosperity Guardian, Yemen remains steadfast in its commitment to blockade and its resistance against Zionist occupation. One must recall the laughable ultimatum the U.S. issued a year ago: cease operations in the Red Sea or face the consequences. A year later, the tables have turned and the U.S. finds itself incapable of issuing any ultimatums.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.